Hello and welcome, and thank you for listening in on this latest edition of the Housing Ombudsman's podcast. Firstly, I'd just like to introduce myself. I'm Victoria Smith and I am a solicitor within the Housing Management and Property Litigation team at Devonshire Solicitors. I act for a number of registered providers, assisting with all kinds of housing management issues. Now, I am delighted to be asked to join Richard Blakeway, the Housing Ombudsman, today. We are going to be taking a look at the latest spotlight report on noise complaints, Time to be Heard. And I've got a list of questions here on the report, which I'm going to be posing to Rick to provide further insight and on some of the key issues and recommendations within the report. So firstly, Rick, can you tell us why you decided to write the report?
Thanks, Vicky. So about 18 months ago, we were looking at our new powers to undertake kind of deep dives into areas to look at systemic issues that may be driving complaints and resident dissatisfaction. One of the areas which we identified was damp and mould, and we obviously did our report on that. The other area was noise nuisance and noise-related complaints. And even though the issue is perhaps talked about less and focused on less than, say, disrepair, it's an area which we know can be a significant driver of complaints to landlords and can be hard to handle. I would say just there was another reason as well. And I recall meeting a resident at one of the open forums that we do, and the resident had had their case investigated by us. And their case involved noise nuisance, but it wasn't ASB. And they felt really dissatisfied with the outcome. And that sort of stuck with me, because even though the decisions were right, I could see from their perspective, they felt it was unresolved. And that's really stuck with me and becomes quite a big theme in this report.
Yeah, I think that's the point we're going to highlight a bit later. So yeah, definitely. Thank you for that. Now, in order to prepare the report, I understand that you issued a call for evidence. You were also assisted with by four different organisations. Can you tell us more about the responses you received and how you used that information to reach the findings within your report?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, most of these reports have been, you know, based on the evidence base derived from the complaints we handle and the investigations that we undertake, and hundreds of investigations contributed to this report. But we feel that it's important to try and get a kind of 360 view and to enrich that evidence base. So one of the things we do is a call for evidence. We had over 200 response to that call for evidence. And I think what's striking in the report is the contrasting views of residents compared to landlords. You know, the even in areas where you might say, you know, there should be some commonality. So take, for example, mediation. You know, very few residents, I think something like fewer than one in four residents said that mediation was offered, but three quarters of landlords said, oh, we routinely use mediation. So just this big gap between expectations and experience. And the other thing, as you rightly say, is that we engaged with four landlords who represented the members of our scheme, so a mix of local authorities, different sizes, different parts of the country, and different outcomes on noise. So some who have higher rates of maladministration following our investigations compared to those. And that was a really useful opportunity to engage with both those landlords and residents to understand actually at the, you know, from their perspective, you know, what it's like handling these, what has changed over the years, and in particular, what is it like engaging with other agencies who are involved? Because the landlord, so often in these cases, is not the only actor. So getting a sense of those kind of that sort of engagement with other parties was really beneficial.
Yeah, really important point there. Yeah, definitely. Now, as you've already touched on, the report notes that at the heart of the findings was the fundamental unfairness that most noise reports concern household noise rather than ASB. And yet, most reports were handled under the ASB policies. I think from review of the report, there was 76% of landlords dealt with noise nuisance by ASB policy. Now, it seems there must be a shift in approach, with landlords having a more proactive good neighbourhood management policy. And the report also recommends some changes to ASB policies. Now, Rick, can you give us some guidance on what changes should be made, both in relation to a good neighbourhood management policy and an ASB policy? And also, do you have any examples of where landlords might have got this right?
Yeah, really important question. So just to touch on this point, you know, too often landlords will view noise through the prism of the person and not the building. And I think that's just really unfair. It's unfair to the person who's complained about, and it's also unfair to the person who's making the complaint. Because, you know, where the issues may be about, say, noise transference, you know, that resident can just end up in some sort of kind of purgatory of, you know, diary sheets and, you know, records to try and prove that their neighbour's been antisocial. And that when in reality, it's not going to reach, in many cases, that statutory threshold. So they're just left in kind of limbo. And I think that, so I think that is absolutely key. Now to get this right, and I think, you know, I have to say, I do think also it reflects a kind of, you know, do the policies and approaches of social landlords reflect their social purpose, reflect their values? And, you know, that kind of grain of unfairness, I think is really departs from the kind of role that most social landlords will want to perform in their communities and the relationship they want with their residents. Now, look, in terms of getting this right, firstly, I think triage is key. So, you know, depending on obviously the scale of the landlord and the complaints it's receiving, can it distinguish between what may be genuine ASB or potentially ASB from something which may be, you know, as I say, a kind of, you know, sort of household noise, possibly accentuated by the building? And then how can you have a good neighbourhood policy which kind of supports that and is a bit more embracing, a bit more holistic? So you're not just relying on the ASB policy, but you actually have a good neighbourhood policy. That good neighbourhood policy, where it works best, you know, can help prevent issues as well. It can, you know, and there's a number of policies actually that are flagged in this report, which we think could be adjusted and improved. But developing a good neighbourhood policy, a good neighbourhood strategy is a key one. It means engagement in the community and so on. And we saw, and it includes those four landlords that we did work with, we saw some really good examples of community engagement. We saw how it was highly valued. We saw landlords thinking about how they might prevent instances of noise. We saw landlords really trying to actually, in some cases, fill in the gap where other services should be doing something. To try and make sure that, you know, that they were supporting their residents. And I was really struck actually by some great engagement work that landlords did, which we mentioned in the report, particularly on estates and particularly on outreach. Yeah, it can be resource intensive, but it's clearly highly valued and seen as highly effective by many landlords.
Yeah, I agree. And I also like the idea of when you're reviewing your policies, engaging with residents in those reviews. I know you mentioned that a lot in the report as well. I think it's a good point. So just moving on to the decent home standard, I know that that's a key issue in the report. Can you please explain what issues you found with that standard and why you consider it should be reviewed to reflect modern living?
Well, look, the standard's 20 years old and it sets the kind of expectations around, you know, properties and quality of homes in the social housing sector. And look, the government, we know, has been really open as part of its white paper on social housing that standard, you know, was due for review and refreshment. And obviously the standard's come into particular focus recently because of issues around damp and mould. But I have to say, if you look at the standard and its treatment of noise, it's incredibly narrow. I mean, it talks about important issues like, you know, traffic, vehicles, you know, trains, I think, you know, it talks about factories. So this is important stuff, don't get me wrong, you know, but it's entirely focused on external noise. Yeah, internal noise is just absent. And I think, you know, reflecting the kind of homes that have been developed over the last 20 years, clearly an increase in density, that you know, denser development that you've seen over that time frame, it is obviously due to be refreshed and reviewed, and you know, and can frankly sound a little archaic when you look at the kind of experiences that we've seen in our complaints that residents are having and the kind of issues that landlords are having to deal with. And it seems entirely appropriate to me that the Decent Home Standard's the one that really sets expectations and sets you know, a kind of benchmark on dealing with an issue which is obviously a really big issue for many residents and crucially could affect anyone tomorrow. You know, I mean, the cases that you see in this report, that we, the stories that we tell of residents, could happen to anyone tomorrow. There's nothing, you know, and in some ways you could argue there's nothing kind of different about the noise that people in social housing experience to any other tenure. What is different, though, is the presence of a professional landlord and therefore the role that they can play in the policy framework that can be put around that.
Yeah, great. Thanks, Rick. So the report also recognises that issues with installation are significant and that they should be considered as part of the landlord's wider work on carbon reduction. The report also sets out some handy tips for more immediate and practical steps that landlords can take now to address issues of noise reports. It recommends that the void standard be updated. Rick, can you please explain some of the recommended changes to the void standard and why you consider that they might be helpful?
Well, it's a moment for intervention. And actually, the more I reflect on our work, the more important I see the void standard and the role the void standard performs. And so we've picked it up in this report. We've actually alluded to it in previous Spotlight reports. And I think it's something I want to look at going forward. And, you know, here, particularly if you have, I mean, I think this should be routine, but particularly if you have had reports of noise nuisance, you know, movement, you know, that void is an opportunity, that vacancy is an opportunity to think about, well, are there measures that we can take? And one of the really practical things that we flag up in there is anti-vibration mats under white goods, you know, the idea of people using washing machines. People are incentivized through energy costs to, you know, charging to, you know, potentially to use those kind of goods outside, you know, normal hours. And then, you know, the carpets. And I get that, you know, people might be worried that, well, you know, are we going to, you know, be liable if the resident's unhappy that we let the carpet was left down? But I would have thought that a waiver would make it possible, as indeed you might see with mutual exchange, would make it possible for that kind of furnishing to be left in place, because evidently the absence of carpets or the presence of hard flooring can be a significant driver for noise. And it just seems a missed opportunity not to address it when there's a void.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. It's really interesting and helpful. Allocations is another key area mentioned in the report. It's recognised that there is an uneven playing field between housing associations and council landlords on the information available at letting stage. Can you please explain more about the unfairness you found and what powers housing associations could use to access information and why that information is really important?
Yeah, I mean, this is one of the things which came up during that engagement with, in particular with the four landlords, but we've seen it elsewhere as well. And I think there might be a mix of reasons here. So whether it is just an absence of relationships or developed relationships, or whether actually the kind of bureaucracy has kind of unintentionally led to housing associations being disadvantaged. But typically what we're seeing is that where the council is the landlord and has nomination rights, it is sharing information with the management arm that can lead to it understanding actually, you know, might there be any sensitive lettings here or any issues that we, you know, might need to address to prevent the issues. And that's not, from what we saw, that's not the kind of relationship that many housing associations have. And sometimes it's because data protection has been invoked as a reason not to share that information. But we, you know, our view is that it's an entirely legitimate reason to share information with housing associations. And that would just allow them to either, you know, to think about sensitive lettings, to think about, you know, some of the issues that, you know, they might need to address if it, you know, depending on the nomination. Look, I totally get there are acute pressures on housing stock those challenges are obviously very real and very acute, but nonetheless, you know, allowing for a more intelligent approach by not being too restrictive around data protection where it is appropriate to share information and reflect the information that would be shared within a council between its management arm and its allocations arm seems to me entirely reasonable and would result in better outcomes in some cases.
Thanks, Rick. Now, you've already picked up on this session of issues with third parties, and it seems that resources are dictated by a postcode lottery. Now, noise reports are complex, as we know, and they often involve third parties, such as the police or environmental health. And the report found that landlords can receive poor responses from those third parties. Sometimes responses are inconsistent or there is an undue onus on landlords by other agencies to act beyond their roles and responsibilities. Now, Rick, can you please give us some guidance on what needs to be done to repair or possibly strengthen those relationships and what you think this might achieve?
Yeah, so, I mean, a couple of thoughts there. So the first thing, it's a really important area. So I think the first thing to say, actually, is that, again, this is perhaps a reflection of how noise has been sometimes treated in a slightly one-dimensional way and seen as, you know, antisocial behaviour, because many of those bodies are involved because of the policy and the statute around antisocial behaviour. And it's just, I can't emphasise enough, as we talked about at the start, the importance of landlords being more holistic in their approach on noise. You know, look, you know, even, I'll give you a small example, because it is important, you know, I think, is that, you know, even just the unintended, I think it's unintended, offence that can be caused to a resident when they're told that their noise is low level. You know, and I can see why the landlord and the landlord staff are thinking it's low level because it's not reaching those kind of statutory thresholds. But for the resident, it's very real and it doesn't feel low level. Otherwise, they probably wouldn't have complained about it, you know, and it's just sucking out the kind of empathy and effective communication and you know, with residents. But where it is potentially a kind of an ASB issue and statutory noise, then obviously there may be other agencies involved. You may have the police and environmental health. I think one of the things which was really striking from the call for evidence that we did is that landlords give the impression of routinely involving environmental health. Residents don't see that. And the awareness of mechanisms like the community trigger, which is this kind of all agency kind of review of the case, just almost non-existent awareness amongst residents of that and therefore their rights to ask for that. So I think there's a real information thing there. And then you come to the kind of actions. And I think, you know, unfortunately, I think a lot of these agencies are stretched, but you're seeing environmental health perhaps stepping back unless they see it's a really serious kind of issue to get involved in. And you see perhaps the same happening with the police. So landlords are kind of filling the gap there. Or conversely, you might see that some of those other agencies, you know, expect more from the landlord, as you said in your question, expect more from the landlord than they would do, you know, say a private landlord, you know, and I think that's, those relationships need to be reset. And I think it comes down to, you know, what is reasonable, what can be effective. And in some places it will work, some places it won't. But what I was struck by is often it's kind of, there isn't really a kind of developed relationship for information sharing, routine kind of engagement, a kind of service level agreement almost between those bodies. And that's, that I think improving that would have many benefits, not least to ensure that, where there is a really serious issue, it's dealt with effectively and timely, but also that residents are much clearer about the other bodies who are involved and their rights and things like the community trigger. So they can think of those routes as well. And potentially pursue that avenue where appropriate.
Yep. Great, thanks, Rick. Another big issue, record keeping. So much so, it is the subject of your next spotlight report. I understand there is that call for evidence out at the moment, and that closes on the 23rd of December, I think it is. So if anybody does have any information, please do submit those surveys. But in relation to record keeping, can you give us some detail on trends you found in relation to record keeping and explain why good record keeping is so important, particularly in relation to noise complaints?
Yeah, I mean, I think there is record keeping is absolutely, as you say, one of those issues which we are frequently seeing across our casework. And in the cases on noise where we upheld the complaint, record keeping was, poor record keeping was prevalent in about half of those cases. So, I mean, that's not great, albeit it is better than perhaps other areas where, sometimes we see almost 2 in 3 complaints upheld have poor records on them. I mean, the effect of this is, it manifests itself in different ways. So the first is that obviously it impedes really effective communication with the resident. If the caseworker is not able to access accurate records, timely records, up-to-date records, then there can be misinformation, mismanagement of expectations. Secondly, you can obviously, therefore, that can then lead to the missed opportunities as well. So, if people aren't aware of, what action should have been taken or have been taken at any given point, then it's just going to lead to missed opportunities. And this is where so often when I was talking to residents during the development of this report, they just weren't clear what was happening. They'd made their report. They felt they'd taken actions. They'd done what they were asked to do. They got the diary sheets. They might have made the recordings, using apps or whatever. But they just were really unclear where it was leading. And poor records can then also extend the timescales. So, because of those missed opportunities and because of those poor records and actions not being taken, these things can be elongated. And, entrenchment of an issue is obviously common across many cases that we see, and certainly where we uphold them. But in noise, it just means those parties are, becoming really entrenched in the issue. So something like mediation could have been deployed more effectively and earlier, but may not have been. And that may be a result of poor records or certainly a lack of grip, if you like, on the case. If you poor records makes it hard for a landlord to grip a case. And the lack of grip is potentially going to drive service failure.
Yeah, absolutely agree with that. Now, along with the Spotlight report, you have issued a letter to landlords where the maladministration rate was 50% or more in relation to noise complaints. We are aware that there has been a significant increase in findings of maladministration and severe maladministration, and this is part of the Ombudsman's more proactive approach. Understandably, landlords want to avoid these findings. And personally, from speaking with clients, whilst they are aware that caseworkers do have a considerable amount of discretion when investigating, they would like a bit more clarity on the criteria applied in deciding what finding to make. Now, Rick, just taking a noise complaint as an example, can you please explain what factors might result in a finding of severe maladministration rather than maladministration?
Yeah, I can, and I can't. I rarely see a case of severe maladministration involving noise. So typically, we're not seeing cases result in that outcome, and that may be partly a reflection of you know, that, as I say, that very antisocial behavior policy approach, and that, you know, so whilst it might not resolve the issue and it might not drive the right outcomes, and there may be unfairness in that approach, or narrowness in that approach, you know, it's, you know, it, landlords are, you know, I'm not seeing severe maladministration come through, yet. However, you know, more broadly, I think, you know, I mean, maladministration as a concept has kind of been out there with our service for a quarter of a century, and for, you know, other ombudsmen for, you know, over half a century. So it's not a new concept. And so a little bit of a sort of challenge to the sector that, you know, they should be able to understand the, you know, the role that maladministration plays. Our scheme sets out, our approach and where we make a decision involving maladministration. And then in October, we published a suite of guidance around the revised scheme that we produced following the removal of the designated person. This was the kind of referral mechanism by elected representatives to the ombudsman. That includes in it, and I would strongly encourage landlords to look at this to understand it. That includes, for instance, our remedies guidance, and it sets out the thresholds on compensation, for instance, just one remedy that we might have, you know, but it sets out the thresholds. And so for severe maladministration, as you'd expect, it's a kind of, accentuated failure. So typically what we're seeing with severe maladministration may be extended delays. It may be, you know, poor decision making outside of the policy, or you know, the policy not being clear about the decisions that needed to be made. You can see a particularly adverse impact on the household. And so I think, you know, every case under law, we're obviously considering the, you know, the individual circumstances. And that means that in itself, every case is slightly different. You can see those common themes across severe maladministration: extended delays, missed opportunities, particularly adverse outcomes on the residents. And that might tip it into a finding of severe maladministration for us. But as I say, noise, we don't see severe maladministration much, but on something like damp and mould, I think about half of our findings of the severe maladministration in the last financial year involved damp and mould.
I know that'll be really helpful to a lot of landlords, so thank you for that. And then finally, the report recognises the economic challenges currently faced by landlords, and that there is a risk that noise nuisance is being pushed to the margins. Landlords are prioritising other issues, which is understandable. As you just mentioned, damp and mould is a big topic at the moment. You've highlighted that in your Spotlight report. You've also highlighted that in your recent letter to landlords. And whilst this noise nuisance report recognises that noise nuisance isn't at the top of the priority list, it does note some practical and cost-effective recommendations that can make a real difference. Now, I know you highlighted a lot of those today, which is great, and thank you. But just as a takeaway, if you could pick one or two recommendations that landlords can take away, what would they be?
Yeah, I absolutely sympathise that there are those real challenges there for landlords. But I think our report sets out very clearly why this actually really, really does in that kind of, you know, perfect storm of issues. Noise is, you know, not to lose sight on noise is critical. I think probably a couple of things just to briefly highlight. So I think the first is obviously this idea of the policy. You know, good policy is just essential for consistent and effective decision making. So, you know, if 3/4 of the noise reports being raised are about household noise, but 3/4 of the, you know, landlords use their ASB policy to respond, that's obviously not sufficient, I think, for an effective and fair, reasonable response. And therefore, I think getting the policy right, the policy framework right, would be one of the most important recommendations to consider. The second thing is just back to this point around communication. And I think one of the things which was troubling in some of the cases that I looked at, some of the investigations that we looked at, was, and the strongest I would put it at is unconscious bias. I don't think this was intentional, but was, you know, the resident who's perhaps elderly might be complaining about noise from children, or the resident who's complained before. And, you know, it was a reasonable number of cases where you could see that the resident said, I'm not being listened to here because of who I am making this complaint. And, you know, you look at it and you look at what the action that what the landlord did or the actions it didn't take. And, you know, that it hadn't thoroughly investigated. It hadn't followed its policy of producing an action plan. You know, the steps weren't taken. The tone of communication wasn't quite right. And I think that is, you know, that can be quite corrosive, I think, for that landlord-tenant relationship. And so, I think it's, you know, possibly it also reflects just a fatigue, perhaps, on case handlers. You know, there's another complaint. Sounds like the last complaint, you know, and you just that loss of empathy. And I think that, you know, it's probably broader than noise, but I think that's really important because obviously those guys are doing a hard job at times. They've got to, you know, sometimes they've got to be resilient and it's how do you make sure that they don't lose empathy? You know, and that perhaps came through in a few cases and I think it's probably an area to really reflect on, you know, if you're going to get effective communications and in the current climate, effective communications have never been more important.
Yeah, I agree there. Well, thank you. That is the end of all of my questions. Like I say, thank you so much for answering my questions today. I think they'll be extremely helpful to many people. There's a lot to take away there. So thank you. And thank you for inviting me to join you today.
Brilliant. Thank you so much.
Thank you.